If you would, go to Ezra chapter 6. We're going to continue there. I did not put up the handy-dandy little... Pardon? Yep, timeline. I don't think it's really necessary for tonight. We're still in that period of time where the temple is being rebuilt, and we're picking up from chapter 5, and actually chapter 5 and 6. When I put this lesson together, I had chapters 5 and 6 grouped together, and I'm going, there's no way I can get through this in one. But they kind of coincide with each other, because if you remember, we went to Haggai, and then we done chapters 5 and 6, but it's all kind of one big pot, if you want to stir it all together. It's about the people are finally getting back to work. Now they're going back to work. So we're starting to see that. Whenever we get to chapter 7, things are going to change just a little bit again. So that's kind of where we're at. But I want to do tonight is finish up chapter 6. But in order to do that, remember in chapter 5, what happened? Anybody remember in chapter 5? They've started rebuilding the temple. They've sat for about 15, 16 years and done nothing. And Haggai, in essence, tells them, it's time to get back to work. The Lord is with you. Get back to work. So they get started. And no more than they get started, again, somebody comes to them and says, what are you doing? Verse 1, I just want to back up to verse 1 and kind of recap so we can keep going of chapter 6. Then King Darius issued a decree because a letter was sent to the king that says, hey, these people are building again, and they're building with these huge stones, and they're very cautious and careful in what they're doing, and they refuse to stop. They're even to the point where they're taking names of who's doing the building, who's in charge of this. They're taking names. And so the king is asked to go back to the records because King Cyrus has issued a decree that says, we can build. And they don't stop this time. So now they go back and they search the records, chapter 6, verse 1. King Darius issued a decree and a search was made. And notice in verse 3, this is what it says. In the first year of King Cyrus, Cyrus the king issued a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the temple, the place where sacrifices are offered, be rebuilt, and let its foundations be retained, its height being 60 cubits, its width 60 cubits, with three layers of huge stones, one layer of timbers, and let the cost be paid from the royal treasury. You'll notice in the letter that they sent, they said they're building out of huge stones, and they're very careful. And you'll notice in chapter 6, they're doing exactly what was in the decree. They're following that too. And notice it's to be paid for from the royal treasury. So not only has God provided for them in such a way that they can build, he's giving them, if you will, the funds and the finances and everything that they need to do this with. Now, I didn't bring this up last week, but you remember whenever the people were enslaved in Egypt? And God said, whenever you leave Egypt, you're going to be well taken care of. And the people were giving them stuff just to go. They walked out of there with all kinds of plunder, if you will. God takes care of his people. Well, here he is. He's taking care of his people. And he says anything that they need, and this will go even farther whenever we get into to this study a little farther, but he says it's to be paid from the royal treasury. So, and let the gold and silver utensils of the temple of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took from the temple in Jerusalem and brought to Babylon, be returned and brought to their places in the temple in Jerusalem, and you should put them in the house of God. Now, I made a statement last week, and I still stand in amazement of this. I don't know about you, but how many times whenever a country or a people are overthrown and everything is plundered, how often do they keep all of the utensils of God's temple? What would you normally expect them to do with stuff like that? Yeah. But notice they've all been kept, and God has provided for them in such a way that everything that they need for temple worship is still there. I find that amazing whenever you stop and you really think about the power and the awesomeness of God and what he can do and how he does it. I just find that amazing. So, verse 6, now therefore Tatnai, the governor of the province beyond the river Shethar-Bozani, and your colleagues, the officials from the provinces beyond the river, keep away from there. So we kind of stopped with that last week. It is, you keep away from there. You let them do what they're doing. Don't bother them. And he says, leave this work of the house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews rebuild the house of God on its site. So he says, you let them alone. You let them do what the decree said they could do. King Cyrus issued a decree, and you're going to help them do it, and you're going to stay out of their way. You're going to help them in everything that they need, and you're going to see that even more as we go. So any thoughts or comments before we go on? Because now it gets a little more interesting again. Okay. I'm going to look at my notes here because I don't want to miss something. Okay. So verse 8. Moreover, I issue a decree concerning what you are to do for these elders of Judah in the rebuilding of this house of God. The full cost is to be paid to these peoples from the royal treasury out of the taxes of the provinces beyond the river, and that without delay. So, again, he's providing for out of the treasury, but you'll notice it's being taken out of, if you will, the taxes, or you know, the people in that area are going to pay a tax so that all of this work can be done. He issues a decree of how this is to be paid for. And whatever is needed, both young bulls, rams, lambs for burnt offering to God of heaven, and wheat, salt, wine, and anointing oil, as the priests in Jerusalem request, it is to be given to them daily without fail. And you'll notice, we'll get into the next verse in a minute, but anything that they need for a sacrifice. So here they are in the building of the temple and what's going on, but are the sacrifices taking place now? And anything that they need, you're to provide what they need. You'll notice he talks about the bulls, the rams, the lambs, the burnt offering, the wheat, the salt, the wine, anything that they would need for a sacrifice, it's to be provided for them. Is God taking care of that relationship that he wants with his people? Can you see how far God is willing to go to have a relationship and to be able to be in a relationship and in covenant with his people? You start understanding the real love and the desire that God has to be with his people. Valerie, do you have some? Acceptable. Yes, good point. Acceptable. And thank you for bringing that up. The acceptable sacrifices. So, what is an acceptable sacrifice? Because I did want to bring this up just a minute. What is an acceptable sacrifice? Pardon? Without defect, okay. But what does it take to give an acceptable sacrifice? Joe. To do what he commanded. Whatever God says is what I'm willing to do. Now, I had a thought about that, but I'm going to wait till we get down just a couple more verses, I think. But it's important to realize that this is the king making this decree to make sure that these people can make an acceptable sacrifice. And it's important to note, he doesn't just say sacrifices, he says acceptable sacrifices. What's that tell you? The king understands maybe a little bit more about what's going on here than people realize. He has to know what an acceptable, or he has to know that these people have to please their God. God has to be treated as holy. This king is not a godly person per se. But he does understand, and you'll understand this just a little more here in a minute. So verse 10, this is why. That they may offer acceptable sacrifices to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. What does that king realize needs to happen for him to be king? Prayer. I need these people to be praying to their God for me that I can be king. Now, well, we'll go back to this in a minute. But he understands that he needs the prayers of these people. Because they've already said, in a way, we were captured by a king, Nebuchadnezzar. Anybody remember Nebuchadnezzar? Do you think this king remembers maybe the stories of Nebuchadnezzar? We'll go back to this a little more in a little bit. And Nebuchadnezzar was overthrown, wasn't he? And we sure don't want that to happen again. These kings realize that, you know, there's something about these people and the way they have their God and how he stands for them. There's no doubt in my mind these kings have to understand that. They may not accept that God as their God, but they understand he is a God that is in control. In many ways, more than one. To the point that he issues this next decree. And I issued a decree that any man who violates this edict, a timber shall be drawn from his house, and he shall be impaled on it, and his house shall be made a refuge heap on account of this. Is that pretty severe punishment? So he says, I'm issuing a decree, and whoever does not follow this, we're just going to impale him on a timber from his house, and we're just going to ruin his house. And may the God who has caused his name to dwell there overthrow any king or people who attempts to change it so as to destroy this house of God in Jerusalem. I, Darius, have issued this decree, and let it be carried out with all diligence. So Darius issues this decree, and he says, I want it carried out with diligence, to the letter, and anybody who doesn't follow it, they're toast. Let's just put it that way. It's not going to go well for them or their family or whoever it is that they serve. So he understands that there has to be something of great significance with regard to their God that they've been allowed to go back and build. And he's not going to stand in that way. Okay, so verse 13. Then Tatnai, the governor of the province, beyond the river of Shethar-Bozenai, and their colleagues carried out the decree with all diligence, just as King Darius had sent. So, the decree is issued, the order is given, and is carried out. Notice with what? All diligence. Now, I'm going to ask you something. If you give diligence to something, what are you really doing? Pardon? You're applying, okay. You're giving it 100% effort. You're giving it the very best effort that you have. I always thought of it like diligence is like this. Now, this is farm boy talk. Whenever you get up in the morning and you go out to feed, you can go out to feed the cattle and you can throw feed and just run and hurry up and get done. Or you can go out there and you can feed your livestock, whatever it is, and, you know, you put the feed in, you make sure they come up, you make sure they're healthy, you make sure that everybody's here, that everybody's taken care of, that they've got water. You're giving some diligence to what it is you're doing. You're not just throwing feed out there. You're checking to make sure that everything is as it should be before you go to the next thing. Or maybe I can put it in another way. I use this from time to time for an example. How many of you ever played basketball? You don't have to really raise your hands, but how important are free throws? If you had a coach like I had, free throws were the game winner. You missed a free throw, you missed a point. And if you missed a free throw, you also got to run the next day till you couldn't run anymore. So at the end of practice, we applied diligence to free throws. At the end of practice, everybody, before they could go shower and go in for the day, you had to line up and you had to make 20 free throws straight. If you missed one, you started over. Now, you think you got pretty diligent at free throws? You gave it your very best to make sure that ball went through the hoop, because the last thing you wanted to do was get to 19 and miss 20. So you give it some diligence because you know it's important that you get it done and done right. Very seldom did the coach ever take pity on us because you missed one. Diligence is important. And I said that to say this. Is diligence important in how we serve God today? Well, it is. Yes, it is. So, where am I at? Lost my place. Verse 14, thank you. And the elders of the Jews were successful in building through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet, Zechariah the son of Iddo, and they finished building according to the command of God of Israel, the decree of Cyrus Darius, Artaxerxes, king of Persia. Now, I'm going to ask you a question here. Think about what you just read. The elders were successful in building. Why? What first? The command of God. Who's actually in control? Who's overseeing this? Remember, Haggai told them, God will be with you. Has God not been working through all of this to make sure that these people could rebuild the temple? So they're successful first because of the command of God. Second, because of the decree of Cyrus, who again was moved or stirred in his heart by God. And the decree of Cyrus, Darius, who again, the king and his heart are in the hands of God and molded just like water. And Artaxerxes, I find that one kind of interesting. I've done a little research on this, and again, I think Ezra, whenever he's writing this, he's looking forward to chapter 7, whenever we read that, because Artaxerxes is going to play a very pivotal role in the temple worship that's going to take place. He's going to play a big role in that. So that's Mike's take on that, but you can take that or leave it. And this temple was completed on the third day of the month of Adar in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. So the temple was completed, and if you remember your chart, it took about 3 years to finish the temple from the time they went back to work. Verse 16, and the sons of Israel, the priests, the Levites, the rest of the exiles, celebrated the dedication of this house of God with joy. Now, did they just celebrate? They celebrated with joy. Was this a great event to maybe be enjoyed by them? Why? How long has it been since they've been able to have God in the Holy of Holies, if you will, to be there with them? Pardon? A lot of years, right? Yeah. It's been a long time. Joe. Yes. They are not able to keep the covenant. Yeah, you're right. And that's where chapter 7 is going to come in, is now they can, everything's fulfilled to where they can go back to worship as it should be, or as it's been prescribed. Because until this time, they couldn't. So you'll notice they celebrated with great joy. Now, we'll ask a question. Do we find joy whenever we come together to worship? Yes. Thank you for saying yes. I wonder how many people come to worship because I just got to get up and go to church today. It was a hard week, and I'm just really not excited about going this time. What does that do to our worship to God? If you remember, just a few years back, worship, corporate worship, if you want to call it that, was stopped for a period of time, wasn't it? Did anybody miss that? What a joy it was to be able to come back together. We ought to always be joyful and thankful that we can join together to sing praises, to pray to God, to be able to read from His Word and learn from His Word, to be able to take the supper together. What a joy and a blessing that is, that God blesses us with that, because they haven't had that for years. For years. And of course, if you go to Philippians chapter 4, verse 4, I think it is, we're told to always rejoice in the Lord, to always rejoice. So anything that we do in regard to our service to the Lord, not just worship, but the efforts that we give on a daily basis, the things that we do, shouldn't that be done with joy? Okay. So now, and Joe brought this up, he was looking ahead. And the sons, let's see, verse 16, the sons of Israel, the priests, the Levites, the rest of the exiles, celebrated the dedication of this house of God with joy. And they offered further dedication of the temple. So here we go. And trust me, this was nothing in compared to what Solomon offered whenever they dedicated that temple. But this was still a big sacrifice or an offering. To dedicate the temple, 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and as a sin offering for Israel, all 12 male goats corresponding to the number of the tribes of Israel. So they have this great big celebration and dedication of the temple to the Lord. And you'll notice it says to the 12 tribes. Now, originally, if you remember, whenever they went into captivity, of course, Assyria takes the first 10, and then Nebuchadnezzar comes along with from Babylon, and he takes the other two, Judah and Benjamin, basically Judah. But now we look at the whole of Israel again being brought back together in covenant with God. All 12 tribes. Then they appointed priests to the divisions and the Levites in their orders for the service of God in Jerusalem, as it is written in the book of Moses. Are they paying attention to the law? There's joy in their hearts, but are they paying attention to the law? Absolutely. They don't want to get it wrong this time, because the last time it cost them 70 years of captivity. Again, maybe a little bit of fear of the Lord going on. And the exiles, verse 19, observed the Passover on the 14th of the first month, for the priests and the Levites had purified themselves together, and all of them were pure. Then they slaughtered the Passover lamb for all the exiles, both for their brothers and the priests and for themselves. So verse 19, this is the first time you see, as Joe brought up, now they can actually observe the feast. They observe the Passover. They're back in relationship with God, as it should be. And you'll notice they've purified themselves. Verse 21, the sons of Israel who returned from exile and all those who separated themselves from the impurity of the nations of the land to join them to seek the Lord God of Israel ate the Passover. Now, I don't know if you know the significance of what you just read there. If you were not Jewish, if you will, a converted Jew, you could still now observe because they were all able to eat now. Verse 22, and they observed the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with joy, for the Lord had caused them to rejoice and had turned the heart of a king of Assyria toward them to encourage them in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. So here they are, the temple is now, temple worship is now taking place. But notice again why. The Lord is the one that's in control of making all this happen. So now they're able to have fellowship with God again. I don't know about you, but think about it: what it would be like to not be able to be in fellowship with God. To not be able to pray to God and know that He hears you or that He cares about you. Do you find comfort in knowing that even in your times of hardship, your times of joy, whatever, you can go to God and you know He's there and listening? And He cares. And here they are. They're finally back in a relationship with God. So, for the rest of the time we've got, and I've got several pages here of notes, I want to just take some time through chapters 5 and 6, and I want us to make some applications on what we've seen. In chapter 5, verse 1 through 5, we've seen, if you will, there was an opportunity for fear this time. The temple had been started, the foundation's been set, if you will, and then along comes some resistance. And you see this opportunity for fear comes up again, but this time they don't quit. Is there a reason for us to back off whenever we're a little bit afraid? Whenever we meet resistance? Or should we trust that God will still be with us and go with us through whatever it is that we're suffering and going through? And, yeah, they've given up on the resistance or given up on the work because of the resistance. The government was against them. The people were against them. There's all kinds of hardship in the way. Sometimes we just have to look past the hardships and realize that by the grace of God, I'll just continue on. And God will make it all work out. I want to bring to you again, God made the people joyful. The people have gone from being discouraged, downhearted, frightened, to where now the temple is restored, worship is restored, and now there's joy in their hearts. And again, I want us to see that, you know, we can have joy in our hearts, no matter what it is that we're going through. And sometimes those struggles that we have in life, they can be hard. But the people found joy in being able to complete for the work that they had started. Yes, sir.
James, talk about joy when you encounter very trials.
Yes, James brings that up. Consider it joy. And well, let's turn over there because that's part of my notes. Let's just turn over there. I'll get out of order, but let's turn over there. J- James chapter 1, verse 2. James says, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. So whenever we endure hardships, or whenever we have trials, or we have things that come before us, and they're making us, if you will, a little bit fearful, or have a desire to back off, is that a test of faith? Now, it's easy to say, count it all joy. There's a lot of things that I've went through in life that really aren't joyful, are they? You've been there? They're really not joyful. But understand that, you know, if we look at it from the perspective of, I'm going to trust God to get me through it, even though it's a hardship, I can find joy knowing that I can persevere and God will be with me. I want you to stop and think. Here's a couple of guys that have been beat, thrown in prison for preaching Christ. Peter and Silas, I think it was. And they're in the prison singing songs. And the prisoners are listening to them. Was there joy in their heart? Whenever they were beaten for preaching Christ, did they go away thankful that they could be worthy to suffer for the name of Christ? Is that joy? Even though you may be suffering or struggling physically, there is an inner joy that comes from knowing that I'm right with God. And no matter what happens, no matter what takes place, He's got my back. As they're in the inner prison and facing death maybe, are they afraid of that? No. There's an inner joy, an inner peace that comes with that. So he says, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. That's what joy really does, if we can dig down and find that peace, that joy, if we're just willing to endure and go through and let God be God and be in control. It's a test of faith. So, thank you for bringing that up, but I did want to cover that tonight. I want to go back to Ezra, though, and I want us to look at another thing that was interesting to me. Because I hear this from a lot of people a lot of times. Well, somebody ought to do something with what's going on in this country. We ought to stand up and stand for our rights, or we ought to form a committee, or we ought to do this, or we ought to do that. Well, in chapter 5, you'll notice they came along and they said, well, who gave you permission to build? And did they tell them? Yes, we did. We told them exactly who gave us. But did they stop? They didn't stop. But what did they do? If you'll notice, he says, we ask, if you will, that you go back and take this letter, if you will, have him go and search the archives and see if the things that we said are not so. We have the right to rebuild. Did they have an uprising? Did they try and overthrow the king? Did they try and do anything of that nature? Was there any kind of resistance on their part other than them sitting there going, we have a right and we ask that you go back and have the archive searched? So my question is, do kings have to be overthrown by us? you never know. If we do that, we might get a more unfavorable king. Careful what you ask for sometimes. Did the nation have to be overthrown? Because if you go back and you look through history, king after king after king, a lot of times, or nation after nation after nation, they just got continually worse. If you go through history, they simply said they turned it over to the Lord and asked that the Lord take care of it. You go back and you ask that the records be searched, and if it's not so, and they let God be in control, and God controls again the king's heart. Now, does that mean that it will always turn out like we want or think it should? Remember again, and I said, you know, earlier in Proverbs, I think it's, I've got it here somewhere, 21. It talks about the king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wants. So he's going to use a king or a president or a governor or whoever. He's got him in the palm of his hand. And he's going to do with them what he wants. So I want you to stop and think about, and I mentioned this earlier. So Darius says, I want you to let them build and don't harm them, don't get in their way, make sure everything they need so that they can pray to their God for me and my sons. And I asked this question earlier. Do you think Darius ever heard of King Nebuchadnezzar? I'm going to ask a silly question here. How many of you took ancient history, whatever they called it, in school? Did you ever study about the Babylons, the Medes, the Persians, Napoleon, and all of those people? Did you ever learn all that stuff in school? Have to learn any of that? Yeah. I sat through hours of that going, oh. And in 1492, Columbus even sailed the ocean blue. I used to just loathe history. Never once, whenever we studied about the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians and all this kind of stuff, did they ever mention that Nebuchadnezzar got turned into, if you will, this critter. You'll not find that in American history books. I don't know if they teach it in any other country, but but I want you to stop and think. There is no doubt in my mind that Nebuchadnezzar remembers the day that he spoke some words and the Lord said, while the word was in the king's mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared, sovereignty has been removed from you and you will be driven away from mankind and your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field. You will be given grass to eat like cattle. And 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High Ruler is over the realm of mankind and bestows on it whoever he wishes. Nebuchadnezzar is boasting about his great power and how he's in charge and in control of everything. And before he gets the words out of his mouth, God says, this is for you. And you'll notice it says immediately, that time. Verse 33, immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled, and he was driven away from mankind and began eating grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, and his hair had grown like eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. But at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and no one can ward off his hand. And he goes on. Do you think Nebuchadnezzar ever spoke of that time? Do you think that that's not in the annals of history, that all of these kings have somewhere heard something and know about? Do these kings understand there's a God of heaven that is in control, that is unlike any other God that we worship? I'm reminded of Paul as he goes into Athens and he sees all of these idols, if you will, these statues, and then there's this one idol to the unknown God. And Paul comes in and he says, I need to tell you about that God. That's who you need to serve. That's who you need to fear. The same God that told Nebuchadnezzar, welcome to reality. I'm the God of heaven, and I control everything. So can we see that God is actually in control? We look at this world and we go, things are out of control. And I do. I look at this world sometimes and I go, how did we ever get to where we are? And it's simply because of mankind and their foolish thinking. And God is using everybody in such a way to give glory to Him. We don't see it and how it works sometimes, but it always works. If the king can hold the heart, or God can hold the heart of a king in his hand like water, can he do that with us? That's my real question. Can he do that with us? And if he can, what's he using us for? For good or for evil? I pray for good. I pray that it's such a way that people see God living in us. I pray that as they look at us, they see God being glorified. Another thing that came to mind was, I want you to understand, we're about out of time here, I want you to understand just how important was it for these people this time to realize they need to get temple worship restored. Very important. Worship to God was of utmost importance. So my question is, did they have to face a lot of hardships and everything to get that done? What are we willing to go through if we want to make sure that our worship is acceptable to God? What do we really have to look at in regard to our lives? Is what do we need to do? And it's something we need to go home and think about. What is it that I need to do in my life that makes sure that my worship is always acceptable to God? Not just Sunday. Go back and read Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. And just see that, you know, our lives are a living sacrifice. And it should be something that is acceptable to God every day.